We'll repeat the question.
Thank you.
Is this working?
Yes.
Good afternoon. The question was, do we have any intuitive sense for what works in slowing down the progression in Parkinson's disease? It does not have to be backed up by scientific evidence. So no study. So that's sort of dangerous territory to tread in, because then I would be saying what's anecdotal, and it wouldn't be scientifically valid to claim that it would work. It's really hard to know. We just don't know. And I can tell you that our experience, and I think the Parkinson's progression varies depending on some of the presentations. So there are some clinical features. Tremor-dominant Parkinson's disease, for example, tends to, in general, progress more slowly. So if we see the tremor, it usually represents a form of Parkinson's that does not get worse over time. With every single general statement that I make, I can say that there has been an exception to this as well. So it's been very difficult to offer any sound advice that someone can grab hold of and say, oh, you know, that's something I should do. So in general, I resort to the helpful advice of staying as healthy as possible, staying as active as possible, getting regular exercise, making sure your heart is working well. All of those things would be helpful in slowing down the progression of aging. So anything that would help in keeping yourself maintained would be my recommendation. Anybody else want to chime in?
Did anybody see that episode on CBS Sunday morning about boxing?
Yes.
Yeah, and you might have seen how the people after those intense workouts, the guy said his arm usually would shake, and he was just standing right there with no tremor at all. So clearly, that's not about slowing progression, but slowing down your symptoms. That's what he said also in response. That was Leslie Stahl's husband who was being interviewed for that. Any question?
Right up near your mouth.
I don't know if this falls under medical or not, but you'll tell me, I'm sure. How does Parkinson's affect other organs in the body, i.e. the heart, lungs? I know that it works on the digestive system in a negative way to a point. And I was just curious as to how it works on the others, especially the heart being it's a muscle.
It clearly has impact on those organs that have innervation, that is, that nerves go to, so that the gastrointestinal tract, for example, is frequently involved in Parkinson's disease, beginning from the top, loss of sense of smell, changes in salivation, both excess salivation and dry mouth, difficulty swallowing, slow movement of the stomach, slow intestinal transport, and then constipation, which is almost universal. And those are thought to be the result of some degree of involvement in the nerve plexuses that go to the gastrointestinal tract, the neuroenteric plexus, for which there's some evidence that the changes in Parkinson's disease can involve that. In terms of the heart, I haven't seen anything in particular about that. The heart has its own pacemaker that we're born with, and it generates its own electrical impulse through its own conduction system, and I don't know that is significantly impacted in Parkinson's. In terms of the lungs, the stimulus for breathing comes from the brain. So obviously there can be lung problems that result from Parkinson's disease. Not taking deep breaths because of weakness, aspiration because of difficulty swallowing, those can be involved, but it isn't a direct involvement of the condition. I think of the different organs, the gastrointestinal tract, also the bladder, the innervation of the bladder, those are fairly common problems also in Parkinson's.
Thank you.
perhaps one additional thing that Parkinson might affect. How about eyesight?
So this is a hard one, to be honest with you. It doesn't necessarily affect eyesight per se, but we know that eye muscles that cause us to move our eyes to pursue objects that we want to look at can be affected. And they can be affected in such a way that people can have changes in how they track moving objects or how they focus near and far by use of the eye muscles alone. Acuity itself is really a property of the eye as a lens system, and that shouldn't be too affected. But there's another aspect of this, and that is that visual processing is probably also affected. So on the brain end of things, how Parkinson patients perceive visual stimuli may be different. And to be honest, I don't think we know as much about that as we're going forward.
Any other comments?
Do you have an experience with vision yourself?
Yes. From time to time.
You want to tell us about that?
Yes, from time to time I've experienced some blurred vision, when I'm driving somewhere. Maybe once every couple of weeks or something like that would happen.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Dr. Coffey said, and what can happen with the eye muscles is that double vision can occur because the muscles don't necessarily work together and can affect reading and sometimes vision further away and can affect looking up, so that that can cause some difficulty with blurring. So those are relatively common problems that occur in moderate to advanced disease.
Have any of you had troubles with your reading, being able to read and track along a page? Yeah, so I've heard about that from several people, and one person told me that she started using a tablet because she can make the words very large, so she's not trying to track across a whole line. Although that can also be frustrating, to be reading one word at a time. That's not usually how we read, so it's difficult. Another question?
What are the stages of Parkinson's? I mean, you know, like cancer has stage 1, 2, 3, 4. There must be a label for, you know, stages of Parkinson's, as in stage 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever.
Okay, that's a very good question. The question is, what are the stages of Parkinson's? And I want to say that there are many stages that we can refer to. For example, the clinical staging is the what is traditionally known as the Hoehn and Yahr staging of Parkinson's. That has traditionally been one people refer to when they commonly refer to clinical staging. There's also pathological staging, so someone might want to say how advanced is the disease from a pathological standpoint. So a post-mortem study might show how extensive are the Lewy body changes in the brain, how far. So that's pathological staging. And both are important ways that we can measure how severe Parkinson's is. And I want to be sure that if you find yourself in a certain stage, it actually doesn't really provide much more information about prognosis other than the fact that it tells you where the state of the disease is. So let me explain. Since we've been describing the Hoehn and Yahr staging, that's the clinical staging. So stage 1 is unilateral symptoms only. Stage 2 is bilateral symptoms. Stage 3 is with some difficulty with balance with bilateral symptoms. Stage 4 is with impairment of balance and inability to walk independently. And stage 5 is complete immobility. So these are very large scales and stages that one can use to describe Parkinson's. But it does not lead to any prediction about how many years left or how many years left to one might have, but it certainly describes some of the difficulty one might have for the risks for injury, for example, for falls, as one of our greatest concerns in Parkinson's is to avoid falls. And so if I describe someone with stage 3 Parkinson's, immediately someone pricks up their ears and says, oh, this is someone who may be a potential for falling, and we want to do our best to prevent falls and make sure that all of the medications that they're on and that all of the activity that they're doing is in place to prevent injury from having falls. So that's where the clinical utility of the staging parameters are. And I think that's one of the many stages. I think there are several other modifications to the staging system as well, but for the most part, the Hone and Yar system has served its purpose well for helping us identify people who may be at risk for falling.
I have a question about the possible autoimmune cause of Parkinson's. My personal question is because I was diagnosed first with psoriatic arthritis and psoriasis, and I recently saw the study at Columbia studying autoimmune cause for Parkinson's.
So the immune system is known for its ability to recognize itself, and there have been a variety of studies to look at autoimmunity. But to my knowledge, in the most common cases of Parkinson's, even in rare exceptional cases, I don't think there have been too many reports of autoimmunity as they would describe in, for example, lupus or other autoimmune conditions in which the antibodies or the immune cells are attacking the parts of the brain that are important for Parkinson's. Does that answer your question, or you had a specific question about was reported in the Columbia study about?
Well, I just read recently about the Columbia study. I was curious because I talked to my GP, and she said, "Well, if you have one autoimmune disease, you may have another," and that was before I was diagnosed with Parkinson's. So I was just wondering if there was.
They're very interesting reports, and to my knowledge, there hasn't been any suggestion that using immunosuppressants, for example, have been found to be helpful for cases of Parkinson's disease. What is exciting, though, is that people are trying to use the immune system to target alpha-synuclein, which is one of the key proteins in Parkinson's disease. And much like the vaccine trials for Alzheimer's disease, where you can prime your immune system to target and remove amyloid beta, which is the protein that's important for Alzheimer's disease, alpha-synuclein, which is typically in an abnormal form in Parkinson's disease, might be removable if you can prime the immune system so that you have antibodies that can remove alpha-synuclein. And people are introducing trials of antibody infusions to get rid of alpha-synuclein, and those studies are ongoing now in the planning stages and I think early recruitment stages, looking for safety of these antibodies.
We have a question back here.
Yeah, a couple of disjointed questions. One, I get different feedback from different doctors saying I've got Parkinson's, and others that say I've got a Parkinson's-like thing. How do you determine what the difference is? Secondly, I get I've had the same eye problems that was talked about here. I can see great on my computer monitor for some days, and other days it's kind of blurry, no matter what I do, can't change it. And thirdly, I've got some symptoms. The only symptom I recognize is a little upper body shake in cycles where I measured it for months now, and for 2 or 3 days I'll have a little shake, and then for 14 days straight, nothing. and then comes back again 2 to 3 days and stops for 14 days.
Okay, so regarding your first question,
can you talk a little bit louder?
Sure.
Thank you.
Regarding the first question, Parkinson's disease versus Parkinson's-like, what does that mean? So Parkinson's disease, the actual diagnosis of idiopathic Parkinson's disease, is a very clear diagnosis. So to meet the criteria for that diagnosis, a patient has to fulfill some very specific criteria on clinical diagnosis when we first evaluate a patient. So there's actually, we call it the brain bank criteria. And this is criteria that physicians use. And this is from examining basically brains that have been evaluated postmortem and have been diagnosed as having definitive Parkinson's disease, and going back and seeing what they actually had when they were alive. So we have been able to determine what a patient should look like if they have definite Parkinson's disease. So the brain bank criteria is a Parkinson's patient should have 2 out of 3 things, and they are a resting tremor or tremor at rest, and only about 40% of people actually have this tremor at rest. The biggest symptom that a patient has to have is bradykinesia on one side of the body, and that's slowness on one side. We look for asymmetry, for sure. Always one side is more severely affected, and rigidity, and then and or postural instability, and that means unsteadiness on the feet. So they have to have 2 out of 3 of those symptoms to meet the brain bank criteria for Parkinson's disease. So if a patient doesn't clearly fulfill those criteria, they might fall into this sort of gray zone where we're not sure what's going on, or they might fall into one of the more atypical Parkinson's syndromes. So often we'll do what's called a CINEMET challenge, or see if they respond to the medication levodopa. And if they respond very, very nicely and have a very nice, robust response, it sort of confirms that, yes, this is Parkinson's disease. But if they don't respond nicely, then they fall into sort of an atypical Parkinson's syndrome, or sometimes a Parkinson's-like syndrome. Now, in 2011, we did come out with a newer type of scan called a nuclear medicine dopamine transporter imaging scan, which took away more of this gray zone. And this does help with some of our diagnosis. And this is a type of a brain scan in which we do get more of a confirmation if someone has Parkinson's or not. So it does show that there's abnormal dopamine levels in the brain, so a deficiency of dopamine. However, it does not tell us if a patient has one of the atypical Parkinsonian syndromes or if they have the regular kind of Parkinson's disease. So again, even if the nuclear medicine DAT scan is abnormal, somebody still may be told you have Parkinson's-like syndrome or an atypical Parkinson's syndrome. So it still leaves the diagnosis up to the clinician if this is idiopathic or regular type of Parkinson's disease, or if it's more of an atypical or Parkinson's-like syndrome. So that might be why the diagnosis could still fall into one of the gray zones. So that may be why. And there's also this whole other vascular type of Parkinson's, or someone may have multiple strokes or a lot of white matter disease in the brain, where it may mimic Parkinson's or look like Parkinson's, but it actually is not at all. There's also something called normal pressure hydrocephalus, where patients actually have normal dopamine levels, but they actually have enlarged ventricles and excess water on the brain. And so they also have a Parkinson's-like syndrome, but they would not improve at all with levodopa. That's actually treated with shunting of the brain to remove the excess water. So there's other reasons why the patients could have Parkinson's-like syndromes. It actually gets quite complicated. So we try to explore all of those reasons and come up with a clear diagnosis. Now, as far as your waxing and waning tremor every so many days, all I could say to that is that perhaps that's just because of fluctuating symptoms, because patients have good days and bad days. And some days, days will be good, and sometimes people will notice that they have particularly bad days. Do you have any other comment about that, fluctuating symptoms? No? behalf of you?
Yeah, it's almost universal that people will report some days are good days and some days are bad days. And I know one study that looked at that found that the quality of the preceding night's sleep seemed to be predictive of how people felt the next day. That is, if they had a decent night's sleep, they functioned better the following day, and the converse was also true. Now that, of course, wouldn't account for your pattern of 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, which suggests some other rhythm, maybe hormonal in some way, or I don't know exactly what. But there are lots of other factors that affect the system of the body that regulate the metabolism of the medications and how one feels and the magnitude of the tremor or whether the tremor is obvious or is bothersome. And I think it's not entirely clear what is causing that in your case.
Do you find that when your tremor is, do you find when your tremor is worse that your vision problems are worse at the same time? Are your fluctuations of symptoms, is it all of the different symptoms are worse at the same time, or?
My vision problems just recently started occurring.
Oh.
The shakes have been there for months. I'll have to measure that.
Okay, so we've got to get back to him for some more data a little bit later.
My wife takes levodopa three times a day, and occurring at this time is leg pain and nausea. I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done about those symptoms.
So the question is, around certain times a day, after taking the medication levodopa three times a day, there are symptoms of leg pain and nausea occurring at the same time, usually associated together. So I typically break the symptoms down separately. The nausea, I usually think about over medication from the levodopa, or basically that the levodopa has been converted into dopamine in the bloodstream. And when there's dopamine converted into the bloodstream, it gets into an area of the brain that stimulates a nausea center. And that nausea is often a symptom of sensitivity to levodopa. And there are various strategies in trying to treat the nausea. It also suggests to me that maybe there's not enough levodopa getting from the bloodstream into the brain where it's needed. And the leg pain might be a form of dystonia, where the leg is cramping, or the muscle is cramping, and that kind of pain is a muscle cramping type pain. And that typically is seen in times when levodopa levels are changing, dropping, and reaching a low level. So I can imagine, and we probably have to confirm through a variety of observations, whether the medication timing and the symptom onset would reflect that the levodopa levels might be dropping at the time. So it might be at the end of a dose, and you're about ready to take your next dose when you're feeling that.
One of the treatments for nausea as a side effect of levodopa is the use of carbidopa. And of course, the Sinemet, carbidopa, levodopa, that combination is typically given together, and it takes, for the average adult, about 100 milligrams of carbidopa to block the enzyme that breaks down levodopa in the gut. There have been some evidence that additional carbidopa given might help reduce nausea from levodopa. And if you're taking only three pills a day, you're probably getting no more than 75 milligrams of carbidopa. So one option might be to discuss with your physician about whether some additional plain carbidopa might help.
I'd like to come back to the fluctuating symptoms one more time. I keep pretty much a regular routine. Sometimes I walk for an hour, from one step to the next, my gait totally goes off. And other days I can walk for hours and then. Any idea what it costs?
Repeat your question about fluctuating symptoms, and within one step, actually, you're such a problem.
So he said that fluctuating symptoms. So even within moments, you feel like your symptoms can fluctuate.
Totally, and I walk. I have fairly normal gait some days, and from one step to the next, my right leg just doesn't function anymore in here.
Okay. All right. So, and do you think that this has to do with timing of your medications during the day? No. Okay. And the other thing that affects the levodopa, of course, is protein interaction. So, and you're aware of this as well. Okay. So, for those of you that don't know, protein does interact with levodopa, so we recommend taking the levodopa a full hour before any sort of protein, because that does interact. So I'm not sure why you might be fluctuating so much.
Can I ask the panelists to speak up a little bit? It's a little hard to hear way back here.
Sure.
Yell it out there. Thank you.
Any ideas, William?
I don't know exactly why you have such rapid fluctuations, but I would say this. Motor fluctuations are characteristic of Parkinson's. The longer you have it and the more severe the illness becomes. And we talk about them with different designations. So there's one that's pretty common is called wearing off. And some of you may have experienced that, where you take the medication, you have a robust response to the medication. But after a set period of time, usually somewhat predictable, it simply wears off before the next dose. So wearing off is one type of motor fluctuation. More troublesome, and usually later in the course of the illness, is what is called on-off, in quotes, on-off. And that just means that the off periods can happen, as you said, suddenly. You could be halfway across a crosswalk and suddenly find yourself in a freezing state. Those are more troublesome to treat. We can sometimes make a difference by altering the amount of medication or giving ancillary medication. So in addition to the Sinemet, we could give Comtan, which is another enzyme inhibitor that prolongs the benefit of Sinemet. We could use direct acting agonists, which are mimickers of Sinemet, mimickers of levodopa. And they may have longer half-lives that would cover those off periods that otherwise occur with the dosing of Sinemet. So there are a lot of strategies, but individually it comes down to talking about it with your doctor and trying to figure out exactly what the problem is. Now, I would also say that as far as emergence of tremor, I think others in the room would tell us that if you're anxious, if you didn't sleep well, if you're hungry, if you have any other kind of physiologic stress, you just got a bill you didn't expect, for example, or a near miss in a car, the tremor can be made much worse briefly just because of the physiologic stress that you're experiencing. So I don't think that answered your question, but.
I think that would be an answer.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm actually surprised that the issue of the recent Georgetown Medical Center research hasn't come up by now, but I'm sure all of you have heard about it. We certainly have. So my specific question is, what is your response as researchers and doctors to what you're seeing? Where do you think it's going? I'd love to know what your take is on what the research showed, because when I read that stuff, it sometimes is fairly incomprehensible.
Right. So you're referring to the drug Tasigna?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
A leukemia drug.
Right. So this is a leukemia drug, and this research was just released a couple weeks ago. So this was a very small pilot study that they only looked at 12 patients using this drug, and These were patients that had fairly advanced Parkinson's disease as well as Lewy body dementia. and they were put on this drug that we use for leukemia. It's already a drug out on the market. And they were patients that were fairly disabled, and they were on it for a period of time, and appeared, most of them appeared to be fairly dramatically improved. So, I read the reports that some of them were, you know, suddenly able to feed themselves where they weren't able to do this before. So, the medication seems promising, but of course, it needs to be investigated quite a bit. 12 patients, it's hard to draw conclusions from that at this point in time. And of course, the drug has a lot of risks. So it has a black box warning for some serious cardiac arrhythmias. It can prolong the QT interval in the heart. So there's some reports of sudden cardiac death on it. So of course, we wouldn't be comfortable just prescribing this for Parkinson's disease at this stage without knowing for sure how safe it is in Parkinson's, and does it actually work, or was this more of the placebo effect, or, you know, so definitely a large placebo-controlled study needs to be underway before we make any definite conclusions, but it's very exciting.
Is that started?
I at Georgetown, I believe that they are recruiting for that, yes.
That just reminds me to tell people, and most of you know this, I'm sure, but there is a website that you should be aware of called clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, as in government, and it is a resource that will tell you, for any illness, what studies are being done and where they're being done and whether they're enrolling and who the sponsors are. And it's a reliable source of information about clinical trials that are either being planned or are underway.
What was that website again?
Clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V.
Dr. Coffey, could you introduce these two people here, our buddies? Stand up, stand up. Two more reliable sources, resources for research.
I'm Polly LeBlanc, Clinical Research Coordinator for Parkinson's Studies.
And I'm Charlotte Jeffries, and I work with Polly in studies as well.
So it's Polly and Charlotte, and you get in touch with them. Just let me know if you want to talk to them about the research programs that we have going here. There's more coming up soon, so clinicaltrials.gov is good, but so are Polly and Charlotte.
Yeah, we like our homegrown trials much better.
Oh, there's a question back there.
Yes. Before you were talking about, I think it was Dr. Bell, about the brain banks post-mortem.
Mm-hmm.
And this may be a silly question, but how can they know that if the person's not alive, how it affects different criteria?
So basically, so what they do is these patients donate their brains to science, and they have their clinical record of how they appeared while they were alive. And so they have all the neurologist notes and all the doctor's visits. And so they see how they appeared clinically. So if, you know, they see if the patient had a tremor or if they had walking difficulties or if they had any sort of dementia, and they correlate the clinical symptoms with a pathological diagnosis of the brain.
I think there were two different things that you were referring to. So she was talking, or a couple of people have talked about the pathology and looking at the Lewy bodies in the brain postmortem, but also there were she was talking, I think, about the symptoms also, where you have to have two of the three cardinal symptoms. So I think those two, what did you call that? The brain banks?
The brain bank criteria?
Brain bank criteria, yeah. So that's different from brain bank, where you're actually looking at the pathology, right?
Well, so the way they developed the brain bank criteria was by looking at the pathology, and that's how they came up with the criteria.
Okay.
It's frequently referred to as the UK brain bank criteria. This was developed from a United Kingdom brain bank, and we're not referring to our own brain bank criteria. So if that's what your question was.
There's somebody who has not asked a question.
Good afternoon. I've recently been diagnosed by Dr. Thoman with Parkinson's,
I'm on no medications of any type, and I'm trying to figure out when is the day when I'm going to have to start taking them. What is a sign that's going to say, okay, it's time? Is there going to be a day I wake up and I say, oh, this is the day? Is there something I should be looking for? That's number one. And the second one is way off the wall. I'd like to know your comments on the ultrasound that was done in Virginia. What your thoughts are on that?
So the first question is, medication about when to start medication is a totally individual decision. It's basically, so you don't have to start on medicine for Parkinson's unless you feel like your symptoms are interfering with your own quality of life. So it's not like diabetes medications where if you don't take your sugar medicine, you're going to injure your body in some way. So it's not like that. So basically, if you find that you're struggling in some way, your quality of life is being hampered in some way by trouble walking or slowness or stiffness or tremor, that's when we recommend maybe it's time to consider a medication. So it's a totally personal decision, totally quality of life issue. So that's what we recommend on that. As far as ultrasound, do you mean ultrasound phallobotomy?
In Virginia.
Yes. Okay. So I actually had a patient participate in that trial, and he did well. So basically, the ultrasound phallotomies, it's a non-invasive procedure where they use ultrasound to lesion the part of the brain, just like we do with DBS. But with DBS, we're implanting a wire into the brain to stimulate the part of the brain, basically to cancel out tremor to help Parkinson's symptoms with ultrasound. So it's non-invasive, they're using ultrasound to basically work on that same part of the brain. But the issue with it is that you can't adjust it over time. So whereas with deep brain stimulation, you have hardware implanted in your brain and you have a stimulator in your chest wall where we could adjust the stimulation over time as the symptoms worsen. With ultrasound, it helps destroy the cells that are causing the abnormal symptoms. But if your symptoms worsen over time, we can't make adjustments as you worsen. So whatever you end up with after the ultrasound procedure is done is sort of what you end up with. So it's effective, but maybe not for everybody.
And can you do that on both sides of the brain?
So it's risky on both sides also, because phallotomy is more risky bilaterally, so on both sides, because there's more of a risk to speech. So there is a risk. I actually knew of a patient who went mute, he couldn't talk anymore. So that's a risk of bilateral phallotomy. So with deep brain stimulation, for Parkinson's disease, we usually do this in the subthalamic nucleus, so a different part of the brain. We hardly ever see those risks happen at all. So patients usually could speak very well after surgery.
I think it's important in thinking about any of the surgeries to distinguish between those that create a permanent lesion, killing brain cells that are gone forever, and those that don't. And one of the virtues of deep brain stimulators is that they don't kill brain cells. And if the electrode were removed, other than a few of the cells that are damaged just from poking the needle there, there's no damage. Whereas in the old days when the cryosurgery was done, freezing an area in the thalamus or in the globus pallidus or other areas, it created a lesion. And my understanding of the ultrasound is that creates a lesion too. So it's a little bit like the old days of doing the cryosurgical thalamotomies and pallidotomies, and that the DBS, although it is more invasive, does not create a lesion.
So where they describe it as being non-invasive, it is still invasive. It just, you don't have an incision on the outside of your skull, but it is invasive. You're losing tissue in your brain, so you have to be clear about that. Once it's gone, it's gone.
To stay on the deep brain stimulation topic,
some groups of physicians seem to recommend deep brain stimulation fairly early in the treatment process for Parkinson's, and other groups recommend it much later on. I'm wondering why the difference. And a second question about deep brain stimulation is, are there things coming down the pike that we would be eliminating the possibility of doing if we had had deep brain stimulation done?
Repeat the question.
So the question is, staying on the topic of deep brain stimulation, what are the benefits of early deep brain stimulation? Because some groups of physicians seem to advocate having the procedure done early versus having it done later. And the second question was, if I can remember.
Does having DBS.
Does having DBS preclude you from having newer technology, DBS 2.0, for example? There are newer technologies being investigated. There are, Dr. Roberts here has been in working with Medtronic trying to look for what they call closed loop systems, where the deep brain stimulation knows how to self-adjust depending on the feedback that it gets, rather than having the examiner examine the patient and say, oh, this setting seems to do better. So a variety of confirmations. You need two electrodes. It's slightly more invasive because you need more sensors to give you that information. And if a closed loop system is ever developed, it may preclude you from being able to undergo the surgery, or may not. It really depends on what the new technology is. But there's always that chance. And the question about having early deep brain stimulation is still under investigation. There was, I think, a major clinical trial in Europe, the early STEM study, in which a German study looking at over 200 individuals with early Parkinson's disease, and that's having the diagnosis within 5 years and being shown to be responsive to levodopa. They underwent deep brain stimulation early, and they found that the quality of life, one of the measures in the study, found that the quality of life was better than best medical therapy. It's important to note that this study did not include a placebo group, so everyone had treatment. And so everyone had some placebo effect. They calculated the placebo effect, and they predicted that if deep brain stimulation really works, everyone would report a response that's even greater than the placebo effect. And they reported that and said that it was the benefit from the deep brain stimulation was even better than what the placebo effect would show. It's not a perfect study, and I would say that it provides some evidence to suggest that deep brain stimulation may provide early benefit, but we still don't have a clinical trial here in the United States that would also provide that supporting evidence. And there is a clinical trial underway where they're recruiting a multi-center trial to look for early stimulation, early deep brain stimulation and early Parkinson's disease as well. This opens up a nice can of worms because there's a lot of uncertainty about early Parkinson's disease. And as Mary had mentioned, there are many typical and atypical forms of Parkinson's disease, and some respond better to deep brain stimulation. And it's very difficult to know when someone is diagnosed early what type of Parkinson's disease it is. And there's a chance that if one person does not have the good form of Parkinson's that responds well, it's hard to know in the early stages of diagnosis.
Can DBS become ineffective over years after time?
Yes, it does not slow down the progression to our knowledge, but it is effective even when medications have near their end of usefulness. We find that it does provide additional benefit to some patients.
The second question was about whether having DBS precluded subsequent technologies being done. As far as we know, the answer to that is no, but that wasn't the case in the era of surgical lesions in Glovis pallidus, so-called pallidotomy, and thalamus thalamotomy, those clearly did preclude other things because they induced a permanent state of damage in those parts of the brain. That isn't the case with DBS. The belief is that the needle is removed and things are restored to the way they were. Whether or not the stimulation itself, irrespective of the needle's effect, but the stimulation, whether that establishes some circuit that can be harmful or make permanent changes, that's unclear. But yeah, there are some interesting studies going on about external electrical and magnetic stimulation as possible treatments that's even less invasive than DBS.
Question back here.
Yes, continuing with on DBS, one part of the question is the financials, insurance, that sort of thing in using that treatment. And the other is, are there any negatives or risks involved?
Okay, so this is a covered procedure, as much as your insurance would allow. It's been FDA approved for about 20 years now. So it is covered, as much as, again, your insurance or deductible would allow. And we do prior authorizations to check on that ahead of time. And with all surgeries, there are risks, certainly. So the neurosurgeons I know quote about 2% risk, but there's always risk. So there's risk, of course, of infection. There's risk that they could hit a blood vessel, that you could have a bleed. There's symptomatic bleeds where they could be devastating, where a patient could behave as if they've had a stroke. Of course, death could occur. Risks of anesthesia. And then we also have non-symptomatic bleeds where sometimes patients seem fine, but then if we do a CAT scan, we see that there's little, maybe micro-hemorrhages, which actually don't, you know, they don't cause any harm to the patients. So there's always risks, but you know, there's also risks to stimulation, so there's some side effects to stimulation occasionally. There's been a lot of studies done to look at some differences in behaviors after certain areas of stimulation. Also, some people gain some weight after DBS, so there's been some studies done to look at that. So there's certainly risks, but most people do extremely well. We do have a great number of people who have had DBS done and who are willing to talk to patients to let them know of their experiences. So if anybody is interested in DBS, we do have a list of patients that are willing to talk about their experiences, and most are extremely positive and wish they had done it sooner.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about some of the therapies that are new. I know, you know, there was that patch that was taken off the market for a while because it crystallized out, and it's back, I believe, right? And then there's the Duopa system, and what was the other one? Rytary. Could you mention a little bit about those new treatments for people?
Okay, so the patch that Diane is referring to is the Retigotine patch. It's NuPro. It's approved for restless leg syndrome as well as Parkinson's disease, as Diane mentioned. Years ago, I don't know if it was 2009, I want to say, it was taken off the market for a brief period of time because it was crystallizing, but they reformulated it, and it's great. It's been on the market for several years now. It works extremely well. It comes in various dosages. It starts at 1 milligram, and it goes all the way up to 8 milligrams. It bypasses the gut, which is great. So it doesn't cause a lot of the GI problems that are associated with Parkinson's disease. It has this 24-hour steady release. It's a dopamine agonist. The other newer medication that was approved in January is Rytary. Rytary is a sustained release carbidopa-levodopa. It comes in a capsule. And inside the capsule, there are micro-encapsulated beads that are time-released throughout the day. It's taken every 6 hours. So basically, if you woke up at 6 a.m., you would take a few capsules at 6 a.m., a few at noon, and then at 6 p.m., and that would be it. So it really reduces the need for the daily, you know, multiple dosings through the day of people that take carbidopa, levodopa multiple times through the day. It really simplifies things. And the other thing that it really simplifies are, as we talked about earlier, all the ups and downs, peaks and troughs of the levodopa motor fluctuations. So for people that have severe motor fluctuations and all of the severe dyskinesias, it very much reduces that. And that also comes in various strengths, and it's easy to convert immediate release carbidopa levodopa over to the Rytary. The problem with it is that it's extremely expensive and not covered well on formularies. So it's been kind of like jumping through hoops trying to get it covered. So that is Rytary, and then we have the Duopa pump that was approved sort of around the same time, I think around February of 2015. The Duopa pump is a dopamine intestinal gel delivery system. It requires a PEG-J tube. So it's a small surgical procedure that it's a small tube that goes into the stomach. It's a very, very easy procedure. If you didn't like it, it's completely reversible, but everyone loves it. It's also for people that have motor fluctuations. It's an alternative to deep brain stimulation therapy. So a lot of people just don't want DBS. And it's a wonderful alternative. People wear a pump. The pump is about the size of, what would you say?
Not this big.
Oh, it's not that big.
it's a small tissue box.
It's
small.
It's not too bad. It weighs about a pound. And
two DVD cases stacked together, maybe.
And every day, a patient just sticks a cartridge of dopamine gel into it, and they push start, and that is it. They don't take pills anymore. And it's just a steady infusion of dopamine gel from the morning, from when they wake up, and they shut it off at bedtime, and it's just a steady release. So they never have ups and downs, peaks and troughs. It really reduces dyskinesia. And if someone notices that they're having sort of any extra freezing or sort of a off time, maybe around meals, they could give themselves an extra dose. There's a button for that. So it's really a great thing. Anything else about that?
Although it got FDA approval recently, it's been in use in Europe for many years.
Yeah, over 20 years it's been in Europe.
The key pivotal trial done in the United States, we're only done recently. That's why it was announced.
Again, what about the insurance coverage for that? Is that another expensive one since it's new?
It has FDA approval, and most insurance companies that abide by the FDA approval guidelines will cover this procedure.
Yeah, it's going through smoothly. It's not like, it doesn't even seem as hard as Rytary.
So that's for the procedure, but how about for the gel that you have to add every day?
The gel, it seems like there's, yeah, sorry. It seems like there's very good coverage for the gel. The drug company has been working very nicely with patients to make sure that they could afford this. So it's really, really nice.
Well, that's fantastic news.
So this is a bad question from others. How come they just don't have a pill form of dopamine, like say, like you do for hypothyroidism? And then if you need the replacement, you can get it in the gel and put it in your gut. Why don't they have something manufactured?
They do?
Yeah. Oh. She was asking about the carbidopa, levodopa. The standard is pill form.
And that's, okay.
But you can get all these different ons and offs and such.
I think you may be asking why we don't give dopamine rather than levodopa.
Yeah, I know it's naturally in food and...
Right. So if you introduce dopamine, plain regular dopamine, as a completed compound into the gut, it really doesn't get absorbed well from the gut into the bloodstream. And more importantly, it doesn't really cross the blood-brain barrier.
Okay.
So to give, and we used to do this, by the way, before my time even, people would need 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams of dopamine to get a benefit, but they were sick as they could be because of all the peripheral effects of dopamine. as a nurse, you know, use it to raise blood pressure in the ICU, for example. So it was, it's just not well tolerated if you give dopamine. The purpose of the carbidopa really is to prevent it from being converted to dopamine until it gets into the brain. So much smaller doses would have the same benefit.
Thank you.
Do any of you know of any foods that would be helpful in terms of increasing someone's dopamine levels?
There's a Mucuna pruriens, which is the bean that contains levodopa naturally. It does not come with carbidopa, because that's a natural product. And you need carbidopa to keep yourself from getting nausea.
Right.
So it still has the same side effects. It doesn't offer any advantages other than the feeling that you, it's more natural because it came from the bean. Otherwise, it's the same. In fact, people have observed in Ayurvedic medicines, people describe a form of tremor and they prescribe this bean for the treatment of it. So we think some in Ayurvedic medicine described Parkinson's disease a long time ago.
It's probably worth mentioning that there are a variety of foods that interfere with the conversion of levodopa to dopamine and can lead to the on-off phenomenon that Dr. Coffey mentioned, the off part of it, and that when one eats proteins and the proteins are broken down in the gut by protease enzymes that break them into their constituent amino acid parts, some of those amino acids are absorbed, will compete with dopamine for binding sites and lead to a sudden worsening. And this has been well described in thousands of people, usually at mid-stage or more advanced stage disease, where after a meal with protein, there will be worsening. And many of you are aware that there are the protein redistribution diets to try to reduce the protein dietary load during the day and then give a full day's protein requirement in the evening meal at dinner time so that at least this problem doesn't occur during the day and it is sequestered into occurring just at the dinner meal. So whereas there may not be too many foods that help, there are certainly foods that can harm and interfere with the use of levodopa.
Is there any type of protein in particular? Any one of the foods in particular, or just general?
As far as I know, it isn't any particular protein because whether it's animal or vegetable proteins or different types of proteins, they all have these different amino acids, and it's those that are the problem. So yeah, I think it's any dietary protein.
My question is kind of complicated. I was adopted and found my birth mother in 1997, and she was having symptoms of the same thing that I did, which was epilepsy. And she got diagnosed with seizure disorder, and now she has Parkinson's. I've been having seizures most of my life, and it's hard for me to think, okay, am I going to wind up with Parkinson's such as I think she did, because she's the one who carried me, and she was having seizures when she carried me. I don't know if that's
very possible. So the question, I think, boils down to if you have a relative, a first-degree relative, like your mother or your brother, with Parkinson's disease, what are your chances of getting Parkinson's as well? And as far as seizures are related, I don't think there's an association between seizures and Parkinson's disease.
She was diagnosed with seizures before, and 2 years ago she got diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Right. So my feeling is that there are a lot of neurological conditions, and someone by chance will have two of them at one time, and that's probably what's going on, is that by chance someone has two neurological diagnoses. But the question about your risk for developing it, and it sounds like there's some heritability from the seizure standpoint, so you're wondering, if I inherited the seizure disorder that my mother has, what are the chances that the Parkinson's is also inheritable? And the heritability is something that people have studied for a long time. Overall, there is an increased risk of having a first-degree relative of Parkinson's disease. It goes up by 30% or 40%. But you have to keep in mind that's relative risk. So if you're looking at the overall risk is 1% in the population of 65 and older, that risk goes up from 1.0 to 1.3 or 1.4. So it's still a little higher, but it's still very low. So there's a statistically detectable risk of genetics influencing your risk for Parkinson's. But the overall risk is still within very much the realm of the typical population. Now there are certain forms of Parkinson's that have been clearly identified as a genetic form. For example, the recently discovered leucine-rich repeat kinase 2, LRRK2 gene, has several mutations that have been found in initially in some European Mediterranean families, also discovered in Asian populations as well as worldwide. There are various mutations that seem to be carried on, and that provides a 50% chance of getting a higher risk of Parkinson's disease. But that risk seems to be varied. Not everyone who has this gene develops Parkinson's, but they are at risk for developing Parkinson's. Fortunately, that mutation is rather rare, but it's still one of the more common forms of genetic Parkinson's. And interestingly, there is no way for us to distinguish between what we call idiopathic Parkinson's disease and some of these genetic forms. They're very much like the typical forms of Parkinson's.
Can I just add one? Just wanted to add one other thing, which is that if you think about identical twins as a model for how we inherit, identical twins are clones of one another. They have precisely the same genome. But if one has Parkinson's disease, the other has no higher risk than if he had a brother or a mother with Parkinson's. So there's that tiny increased risk that we talked about, 30% of a 1%, but it's really not more than that. So I think, as with Alzheimer's disease, which is generally sporadic, not inheritable, I think you could say the same thing for Parkinson's.
I have a question about integrin. Of the three new therapies that are listed up there, that is the only one that's a dopamine agonist and not a levodopa preparation. But does its delivery system make it more reliable or more effective? Can it be used instead of levodopa, carbidopa? Or how is it usually used?
So it's a dopamine agonist, and that's how it's different from the other two. The other two are levodopa, essentially. So dopamine agonists, we tend to use them either as monotherapy, so an earlier Parkinson's disease, or as an adjunct to levodopa, so also to prolong the action to levodopa. But often it's not a substitute for levodopa. It doesn't work as well, actually, as levodopa.
So the advantage to Mipro is that it's so evenly delivered.
Right. And actually, there's the two other dopamine agonists, so Requip and Mirapex, both come in extended release formulations. Mm-hmm. So they also come in one a day, 24-hour release formulas. But this is the only one that comes as a patch that could bypass the gut. So if somebody has swallowing difficulties, for instance, that would be a benefit to the patch.
Are there frequent skin reactions?
Yes, that is actually one of the biggest side effects. We recommend that the patch is changed in location every single day, and the skin reactions can be mitigated very easily, actually, by some just like hydrocortisone cream or some Benadryl cream, but they're usually not very severe.
Now, I'm not a scientist or a doctor, but you mentioned the blood-brain barrier, and that the levodopa bypasses the blood-brain barrier. I'm not too familiar with it. I just know that it's a protective thing for the brain to keep things out and keep things in somehow or another.
Right. So I didn't mean to be unclear about that. I apologize. The blood-brain barrier is permeable to many different kinds of chemicals, but there are some that cannot penetrate. It's largely a product of how big the molecules are. But in the case of dopamine, it really doesn't penetrate. But the precursor, the building blocks of dopamine in the form of levodopa, cross these. And that was the big breakthrough when levodopa was introduced. It could get enough into the brain if you prevented conversion to dopamine by using carbidopa, that you could avoid the peripheral side effects of just giving large amounts of dopamine.
I've got a I don't know if I'm going to be able to pronounce it correctly. Sesquiterpenes, which is something that I gather comes from different kinds of woods. And from what I've read about this, it does cross the blood-brain barrier.
Don't know, but we can look that up.
This is in a Young Living's essential oil. Cedarwood is the one that I found that it, from what I understand, has got the highest concentration of it, to give you something more to be able to.
So this is a nutraceutical that you can buy from a catalog?
Yes, it's an essential oil.
Okay. So that actually raises another question, which is, what are the standards by which we judge pharmaceutical compounds versus nutraceuticals? Mm-hmm. You may recall that a few decades ago, Congress made a law that as long as people manufacturing nutraceuticals made no health claims, they could sell them without any kind of an approval process. So in other words, they were exempt from FDA approval. The provision not to make health claims lasted about 2 weeks. And we now sell more nutraceuticals in the country than we sell pharmaceuticals. Do they work? Can't tell you. Do they have side effects that are unknown? Can't tell you that either. So I would just say, in my experience, most of them are not harmful, but I would be very, very reluctant to accept any health claims. If you look in these catalogs, right down at the bottom, it will say, in spite of the fancy advertising, this is not intended to make any health claims, it's not intended to be medical advice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's very small print. So we can look up that particular one, but if it's a nutraceutical, I guarantee there's very little known about it.
Can I say something? Mm-hmm. I wanted to just clarify about the blood-brain barrier and levodopa. The levodopa gets converted to dopamine at the blood-brain barrier, so the active ingredient is in. I mean, it gets in. So, and as Dr. Coffey said, once you can inhibit the breakdown of levodopa in the stomach and intestine with carbidopa, then most of the ingested amount gets into the bloodstream and it gets across the blood-brain barrier and it becomes dopamine in the brain. So the fact that you can't just give dopamine isn't really a serious problem. The particular substance you're talking about that crosses the blood-brain barrier, there are lots of things that cross the blood-brain barrier, but that doesn't mean they help Parkinson's disease. What is missing in Parkinson's disease at the affected areas is the neurotransmitter dopamine. So it's really only those that either enhance dopamine, like levodopa is converted to dopamine and it becomes dopamine, or a dopamine agonist is a molecule that stimulates the dopamine receptor because it fools the receptor into thinking that it's dopamine.
it's similar enough chemically that the receptor responds to it. So even though it isn't dopamine, it has a similar response to, as if it were dopamine.
Just out of curiosity, is it possible to retrain the brain to use different parts of the brain to take over the function of the missing dopamine part? Just curiosity, I'm sorry.
So there's this question of neuroplasticity,
right,
which I think many neurological conditions, we try to take the most advantage of. The brain has the ability to adapt in certain ways. There are certain limits to that adaptation. You cannot train part of the brain that controls your leg to work on the opposite leg as much. Usually it's not possible. In other words, there are anatomical mapping where those connections just aren't there. But if there are connections that are available and they're not being used, it's possible that through use, you wind up entraining those connections and making them stronger, and those stronger connections might be useful. The biggest example that I can think of that's related to Parkinson's might be what we advocate for Tai Chi, for example. My reason is that you basically place your body in a position where you're about ready to fall. And through motor learning, and we do this, ballerinas do this, to learn how to dance ballet. They practice the art of balancing through training. You don't watch a video, you don't read a book, you put your body through various positions that are very difficult, but through routine practice, your brain begins to learn what's the best position and how to position the muscles and where the joints are. All that motor learning occurs subconsciously. And through that motor plasticity, you can adapt your body so that it becomes a well-oiled machine that can manage postural instability when you're about to fall. And Tai Chi, if you're not familiar with Tai Chi, is a set of slow movements. And it's actually a wide range of body movements. But the modified form of Tai Chi that was used in clinical trials to show that Parkinson's disease can improve with Tai Chi is that that the modified movements are the ones that are useful in training your body to stand at a slight angle. And those selected movements have been shown to be useful. So with the training, there's a way to adapt and get the body to become a little bit more responsive when someone is at a risk for fall.
The Centers for Health and Aging, the Dartmouth Centers for Health and Aging, got a large grant to provide trainings for falls prevention, and it's expanding on that program that Dr. Lee was mentioning, the Tai Chi Quan for Moving for Better Balance, and also another program called A Matter of Balance. So they're busily training people across the state of New Hampshire. And if you're interested in that, please get in touch with me. They run these courses right here at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, but it's going to be dispersed throughout the communities, throughout the state. So please get in touch if you're interested in that. Are you interested in that, or you have a question?
Question. This is like a two-part question. Some people with Parkinson's, I believe they also have neuropathy. And so the question becomes a two-part question. Number one, if you're having some adverse certain symptoms, how do you know whether it's coming from the Parkinson or the neuropathy? And number two, how is neuropathy treated?
As far as we know, there are two independent disease processes, and that peripheral neuropathy isn't really a disease. It's a syndrome that can be caused by many different causes. Diabetes is probably statistically the most common cause of peripheral neuropathy. So people with peripheral neuropathy are now at greater risk of getting Parkinson's and vice versa. Although, as you get older, the incidence of both increases, so the concordance of the diseases becomes more frequent as you get older. Now, both of them can impair balance. So your question is a very reasonable one, that if you're falling and you're feeling off balance, is it the neuropathy that's doing it, or is it the Parkinson's disease that's doing it? So generally, the neuropathy causes imbalance because one loses the ability of position sensors that are located in the joints of the toes and feet and ankles and legs up to your hips. I can't send signals to the brain through the sensory nerves telling the brain what the location is of the joints. And the brain needs that information to maintain balance. So people who have only neuropathy and not Parkinson's do much better with, say, a cane, and much better looking at the floor and using their eyes to compensate for the lack of this joint position sense caused by the neuropathy. To the extent that one, say, closes one's eyes and feels off balance, that is a more common problem with neuropathy. And Parkinson's balance isn't as reliably improved with cane, although cane certainly helps. So I just wanted to make it clear that if you have both of those, they're probably not related to each other. They're more common as you get older to get them, and they both impair balance.
And then how do you treat the neuropathy? Are you taking levodopa for the
first thing with neuropathy is to find out, if you can, what's causing it, and treat the underlying condition if you can identify that. And that sometimes is possible, and sometimes you can't determine what it is. So, for example, if it's diabetic in origin, treating the diabetes can help forestall the progression. If you don't know what's causing it, and tests have been done, and there's no obvious cause, then there really isn't anything other than taking vitamins like folic acid and B vitamins, vitamin B12, for example, that might slow it down a little bit. I think what we do with people with neuropathy is to try to train them to prevent falls by always using a cane or a walking stick, watching where their feet are, always have well-lighted rooms, night lights at night, carry a flashlight if you're walking around after dark, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we are just about out of time. We're going to give the last question to right back here. I just want to say that also brings up the issue about not assuming that all your symptoms are due to Parkinson's, and also not assuming that they're not due to Parkinson's. So always checking in with your doctor about those.
So I came across some information very recently about a product called INOSINE. It's a nutritional supplement precursor to the antioxidant urate and has shown potential as a therapeutic option that could slow the progression of Parkinson's disease. I think it's in phase 3 trial right now, and it's something you can get without a prescription. Any of you have comments on that?
So this brings up the urate study, SURE-PD. There was a phase 2 clinical trial that was published last November, a multi-center trial, looking at raising urate levels. The original idea came out of some observations from Michael Schwartz's trial at MGH, Massachusetts General, who observed that urate levels were more elevated in slower progression and was lower in Parkinson's patients. So urate levels, higher urate levels seem to correlate with better prognosis or slowing down the disease. So the hypothesis is, if we raise urate levels, will we slow down the progression of Parkinson's disease? And through a lot of work on animal models, looking at what urate might do, people came up with the idea of raising urate using inosine. Inosine is one of the building blocks for DNA, and it is metabolized or broken down into urate. So you can take inosine, but and then subsequently raise urate levels, which is the intent of inosine. And of course, many of you may be familiar with urate because excessive amounts of urate can cause gout and uric acid stones in the kidney. So these are serious problems with elevated urate that you have to guard against in these clinical trials. And people are looking very carefully to design the clinical trial so that it's, first of all, safe and efficacious. And then now we're going to look for efficacy. And so the SURE-PD3, I think that's what it's called, is the phase 3 portion of this. And now it is about to be announced that they're going to begin recruiting, but they have not started yet. The site investigator meeting is happening sometime this November. And after that, they're going to start recruiting individuals. We are not a center for that, but the University of Vermont is. And so if you're interested in that, and you have if you like traveling to Burlington and enjoy the sites there, I encourage you to sign up. My colleague Jim Boyd and Bob Hamill at the Binder Center for Parkinson's Disease at the University of Vermont are in this clinical trial, and they would be happy to try to enroll as many individuals as possible. There are certain limitations or criteria. I think the difficulty is that, number one, you can't have gout, obviously. But the most difficult one is that they're probably, and I haven't seen the announcement yet, but they're probably going to ask for early diagnosed Parkinson's patients who have not been on dopaminergic therapy. That excludes many, 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 many patients, unfortunately. And the reason of that is not because we're not interested in patients who are on dopaminergic therapy, but the only way that we can measure disease severity right now is by how bad the exam is, how bad are your symptoms off medication. And it has been our experience that it's very difficult to measure disease progression when someone is on medication. And the only sure way is to measure the whole unified Parkinson's disease rating scale. How bad are the symptoms based on this rating scale? And that's what we're going to go on to indicate whether urate will slow down the progression of Parkinson's. Anyone else?
Okay, well, I want to thank our doctors on the panel today for answering. I can't believe how many we covered, just about everything, almost everything. We didn't cover exercise and physical therapy and such, so we'll stay tuned for that one. In the springtime, we're going to have another question and answer that will include our rehab med specialists, so watch for that announcement. That will be in April. So thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Thank all of you for all those fantastic questions. So get in touch with me if we raised more questions than we answered, or if there are other things like these sesquiterpenoids and such. Yeah, shoot me an email to remind me, okay?